Welcome to episode 380 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature a grand conversation with novelist, essayist, short story author, and professor at Dartmouth University. This gentleman has been published in the New Yorker magazine, the Atlantic Monthly, the Paris Review, among other excellent periodicals, and has a very new work just published in 2019 by Little Brown, titled Maggie Brown and Others. Peter Orner is on the program. And we have, a grand conversation talking about his background, his influences, his process, some interesting anecdotes. I think you'll enjoy it. Great conversation today with Peter Orner. We also have an EW essay titled The Caves, a brand new Uncle Cesare essay written by our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, titled Squirrel Tale, an EW poem called Isabella. And, of course, as is always the case, all of this will be imbued and infused with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 380 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. The caves. Hope and love to keep us from being blown away into an abyss of nothingness. Though my Buddhist friends remind me that hope can embody an unhealthy expectation. What about centered, calm courage? Humility is deep. Can a man like me truly fathom such a threat to my ego? We look in high places for people to model our way of life, as if the perceived stature we process in our weirdly wired nerve endings is a clear and unabashed indicator. Our Western culture of adolescent-styled competitiveness feeds this sort of preoccupation with social influence, material wealth, and physical dominance. I suppose in many ways this helped us get out of the caves, so to speak. But is that the phase of our human evolution, the one we would like to accept as our developmental peak? Being in the moment, hearing the birds sing, coo, and tweet, having a genuine philosophical conversation with someone you just met, thinking of lovers, their touch and their breath, honestly processing the feelings and logic that drive injustice and hate, not taking the bait, kissing it up to fate, perpetually hiding yourself or running away. Characters of fact and fiction overlap and intertwine during this adventure, as the thieves in the daylight are overtaken by the dreamers in the late night sublime, bending the arc of this country more so toward an earnest sense of justice, and filling the soul of each individual with the substance inclined as a natural, pure design that might last us forever.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stop and stare. I can't see their faces. Only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going well, the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze, and skipping over the ocean like a stone. My clothes, banking off of the northeast winds, sailing on summer breeze, and skipping over the ocean like a stone. Everybody's talking at me, can't hear a word they're saying, only the echoes of my mind. I won't let you leave my love behind. No, I won't let you leave.
Hello, Peter Orner. Is that you?
Yes, hi. Hi, Lawrence. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thank you so much for being on Troubadours and Rock On Tours.
Oh, I appreciate it, and thank you for the patience with me today. I've just had a crazy day, but I'm all good.
I hear you. I am having one, too. Let's give some of the folks a little background before we get started with our conversation. Peter Orner is a writer and professor at Dartmouth University. He's a highly acclaimed novelist, essayist, and short story author. He has been published in The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, Paris Review, to name but a few. His most recent work is a book of short stories titled Maggie Brown and Others, published in 2019 by Little Brown. And I'd like to share a couple of reviews from Oprah Magazine. Orner brings grace and vigor to the short story form in a preeminent collection, earning a place alongside Carver and Monroe as he ranges across a broad emotional register. And then we can go to something from the New York Times Book Review, Gregory Cowles. In this collection of 44 compressed stories and one novella about blue-collar men and women and lives that didn't quite pan out, Orner maintains his reputation as a master of the form. It's a pleasure to have you on Troubadours and Rock On Tour. Sir, how's the summer going?
Not bad, not bad. I apologize for the noise in the background. They seem to be doing construction every time I come to my office. There's something new going on. So anyway, yeah. I shut the window, so now I'm sweating in the heat. But aside from that, I'm all good.
Yeah, I hear you. It is a hot one here, too. I'm not too far away from you in the endless mountains of Pennsylvania. You're up there in Hanover, New Hampshire.
Yes, yes.
And let's get started by sharing with the folks a little bit of your background, your journey, so to speak.
Sure. You want me to begin?
Yeah. It's your journey. So wherever you'd like to start from.
And my journey today, I came from White River Junction, across the river in Vermont, where I have a studio. I like to keep my teaching life very separate from my what I call my working life. And so I have a tiny little studio in an old hotel called the Coolidge Hotel, which kind of like an old railroad hotel. And it's a little bit like out of The Shining, these huge, wide hallways. You wonder why they built them so wide. Like, what were they, you know, running trains through them or something? But anyway, that's my journey today, up a hill and into New Hampshire. It's hard for me to say. As long as I can remember, I've been making up stories, and I feel very lucky to be able to do it sort of for a living, you know? I think my first story, I remember in like, it was like sixth grade, they asked us to write about an object in the room, and I panicked. I couldn't think of anything in the entire room to say anything about. And I think I was afraid. And I think I felt the same way this morning. I feel like my life is a journey of panic, basically. Ever since that moment, and I chose to write about an electric socket.
And wow,
a thrilling piece. But anyway,
yeah, it must have been compelling.
Right
now,
I'm trying to dig that up.
I understand, you know, I've been reflecting on the sort of the idea of panic and fear myself. You know, is that a way that anyone should be driven to do things? You know, because I think myself included, when I came up, often that was the way that people got you motivated, you know, whether it be on purpose or just because it's the culture that you're raised in. It doesn't seem like a healthy way to go, but I guess it's effective.
No, I wouldn't recommend it. But it can be thrilling. I think of something Joseph Brodsky once wrote or said, where he says the pilot can, you know, after landing the plane 200 times, can kind of assure themselves that, you know, that they're going to land the plane most instances, right? And I think what I do, there's no assurance of that. none. And that's actually part of the thrill. It's like, you don't know how that landing's going to be. Like, it's not, you don't go on autopilot in this. And so I find that maybe the fear and anxiety can make for good work, although you're right, it doesn't make for necessarily a very settled life, let's say.
Yeah, I guess, sometimes it goes with the old cliche or what have you about artists, they're troubled and they're difficult to be around, but man, they could really come up with some good stuff.
Right. We are difficult to be around, that's for sure. And is it worth it for those people who are around us? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure either. Thankfully, they see things in us that are good that we don't,
Sometimes, anyway.
Yeah. So, your influences, when you came up to it, did you come up, would you say you were middle class or were you working class more so, blue collar or white collar? How was that experience?
Interesting question. I come from a family that has gone up and down in the world, let's say. My mother grew up in working class Fall River, Massachusetts, and her father was a furniture store owner and salesman, and I write a lot about him. Walt Kaplan comes up in this book, and he's actually in, I think, every book that I've written. He always makes an appearance. He died when I was 59. And he died when he was 59. And because I never got to know him, I think much of what I do is trying to get to know that guy, what it was like to be a mostly broke furniture store salesman in Fall River in the 60s and 70s, because they put a highway through his furniture store, so they took it away at eminent domain. Mm-hmm. Anyway, myself, I grew up in Chicago. My dad was a lawyer, sometimes he was more successful than other times. But when my parents split up, my mom was a single mom teaching school as a substitute teacher. And, I think we all felt we'd come down a little bit. We moved out of our house and into another part of town, and it's very different. So I think I've seen things from different sides, although I would say I have maybe a solidly middle class upbringing, let's say.
Okay, thanks for that insight. And your influences, literary influences.
I've been thinking about this because I appreciated your communication earlier. I feel like I'm constantly open to being re-influenced. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have certain core writers and artists, even artists, visual artists that I return to, photographers that I return to again and again. People like Italo Calvino,
mm-hmm.
Giacometti, the sculptor and painter. The photography of Wright Morris, as well as the novels of Wright Morris. He was a great Nebraskan novelist who also was equally great as a photographer. Very interesting guy. He wrote about 40 books and has been completely forgotten. But Wright Morris, although I do my best to sort of remind people of him, as well as there's a few other Morris aficionados out there who do their best too, but he's been a great influence on me because his work, I think, was each book he was just trying something new always. And I don't know if it had to do with the fact that he was also a photographer that influenced his experimentation. I don't know, but he's a big influence on me.
And his first name I'm not catching.
Oh, it's Wright Morris. I'm actually moving locations.
That sounds better, actually.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
How would you spell his first name?
Wright. W-R-I-G-H-T.
Okay, Morris. Good. I want people to be clear on that so they can look him up.
Yeah, yeah. He was, I did a piece on him for the New York Times maybe a couple of years ago, and I was very pleased that they were interested because, while he'd been a sort of big name in his time, he'd really been largely forgotten, so... if anybody's interested, they can look that up. I think it's called In Praise of Wright Morris, something along those lines.
in praise of Wright Morris. And you mentioned writers and photographers and sculptures. How about, I'm curious, music. Do you find any inspiration there?
Sure, a lot. Lately, I've been listening to a lot of Silver Jews, David Berman, who passed away maybe a year or two ago. I tend to go in binges, you know. I listen to a lot of Townes Van Zandt. I like storytellers and music. I just drove across much of the eastern seaboard, and I listened to a podcast about the Clash, which was fascinating, and it hosted by Chuck D of Public Enemy. It was really an amazing sort of look at music from another, from you know, a guy who did very different music, but was clearly influenced by the Clash and some of the things they stood for. Fascinating, and that was inspiring. So what I started to say was I'm constantly open to being influenced by new things, and constantly open to being re-influenced by stuff that, you know, I go back and I look at what has moved me in the past, and I wonder why that is. You know, so I'll go back and reread Go Down Moses by Faulkner. I read that book probably once a year. Moby Dick, things like that. Eudora Welty is a huge influence on me. I read Toni Morrison's Sula every couple years, just to get that sort of torque in the language, the intensity in the language. And so, you know, I tend to revisit the influences as much as I look back fondly on them. I always want to kind of say, well, what was it that, you know, that got me?
And I wonder if you find different things when you go back to that you didn't find the last time.
That's the thing. Yeah, exactly. It's completely new, you know, these books. They become, you know, they don't just sit in your memory as sort of like an archive of a good time you once had. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They're alive. To the Lighthouse. You know, I go back and I read that. I'm stunned by it. But not for the same reasons I was stunned the first time.
And, you know, that has to be the person reading it, right? I mean, the book is the book.
Yeah, I think we change. You know, we change. And you know, I think that, again, I think it's worth studying sort of what it, you know, you have this fond memory of something, a very intense memory of something, but it's unspecific, you know? And I feel like when you go back, it can become reanimated. But yes, you're a completely different person. And I tried to capture this once in an essay about rereading To the Lighthouse and how I was disappointed in myself for not feeling as intense as I once felt. It happens. But I felt something different. Maybe I was looking at more intellectually, which I think is too bad, but sometimes is inevitable.
Yeah, so getting too cerebral could be a bad thing.
Yeah, like trying to study the impact on myself too much, as opposed to just letting myself go to the work. You know, that's a big danger in writing stories, you know, where you intellectualize it too much. You want to make sure people understand it, and you lose sight of the organic feeling you're trying to convey. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. Well put. We're talking to author, professor, among other things, Peter Orner. And how about your garage? My associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, who teaches literature and uses your work in his classes, he asked me to ask you this. Describe your garage and your book of essays.
Well, that's very nice of him. I'm honored he's teaching the book. And my garage, which is my former garage when I lived in the Bay Area in San Francisco, I had an office in a former garage. It wasn't functioning as a garage anymore. It had been I described this in the book, but it had been a sort of apparently it was a porn studio at one time. And so it had really good lighting, really intense, let's say very intense lighting. You know, it was kind of a makeshift porn studio. Let's say it wasn't a real professional operation, but it had these intense light. I mean, I would sit there and sweat in the lights, you know, down there in the basement. I think it kept the mice away, the heat of those lights. But Anyway, so, and I just filled it with books. I mean, I just, you know, like you and probably many other people listening, I love books so much. I feel like I just need to keep acquiring them. And I had room in this garage, so I just filled it and filled it and filled it for years. And I would sit down there and just almost agonize about how I would never in one, two lifetimes or five lifetimes, much less one lifetime, make even a stab in at reading all the books that were down there, especially since I'm an extraordinarily slow reader.
Well, you know, you just, back to Dr. Michael Pavese, that's exactly what he said to me one day. We were in his apartment. He, you know, the walls are lined with books, and I said, man, this is impressive. He goes, nah, it's depressing. And I said, well, why is it depressing, Michael? He said, because there's no way I could read all these in my lifetime.
Right. He's got it right. But there's a certain kind of joy in that too, isn't there? You know, that just that at least you'll be kept busy.
Yeah. Yes. Well said. I agree with that. You know, you can't say that, I have nothing to do. Yeah, you do.
Right, exactly. Or you can't, you know, oh, I don't have any ideas today. Well, you know, take a look at all these other people that had all these ideas that are largely forgotten, but, you know, take a look. I think William Maxwell is another one of my heroes. Had something beautiful to say, a spin on kind of what Michael said and what we were just talking about. But he said, I forget exactly what it is, but he says something very, you know, where he, you know, he almost revels in the fact that he can't finish, that it's an unfinished job to read all he wants to read.
Yeah. I could totally understand that. And I guess when you're reading is one thing. How about writing? Do you look at your writing in that way as well? Like there's just so much to write about that you don't have enough time to write about at all?
I feel very differently about the two things. I don't feel the same way. I mean, for me, writing doesn't come easy, and it doesn't come with I don't know how to say this, a lot of largesse, let's say. You know, it's like, you know, squeezing blood out of a stone sometimes. And I think I've just sort of come to grips with that. And, you know, my basic thinking on this is that I just, you know, when I feel like I can't not say something, then it's time to say it. Otherwise, I hold off.
When you feel you cannot say something, that's the time to say it. Did I get that right?
I think I had an awkward double negative in there. When I can't not
right.
say
it. Yeah, I didn't say it right. When you can't not say.
Right. That's the thing. Otherwise, I'll let it ruminate. You know, I won't. I'm a firm believer in just this for myself. Everyone's got a different process, but that I don't force out the words. If they don't come naturally, I don't tend to try and find them. I just wait.
When you're choosing, or maybe it's not a choice, when you embark on writing an essay, a short story, or a novel, how is it a matter of what you have to say, or you're not sure where it's going to start? Is it going to be a novella, a novel, a short story, essay, and then you just find out as you go?
That's right. Yeah. That I try not to have too many preconceptions about it. I mean, I guess I'd say this is mundane, but you know, if it's nonfiction, I generally know, but because I'm like, because of my instinct is always to write fiction. Oftentimes I'll start out with something that's true and then I'll start lying about it. And then it turns into fiction.
And, how about your book of essays? Are We Alone Here? Excuse me. Am I alone here? Uh-huh. The question that is connected to that. Are we alone here? Have you come to understand, are we alone here, while exploring that title, Am I Alone Here, via that book of essays?
I mean, The title comes from something I would say to myself, you know, or sort of as a rhetorical kind of like, am I alone here in thinking this?
Yeah.
Am I alone here, you know? And I got a house full of, well, it feels like a house full of kids. There's two of them. So I wish I felt more alone. Let's put it that way.
How old are they?
I got a 10-year-old and a 3-year-old. So it's quite a spread. But I think with this pandemic, certainly it's felt a little bit like we're sort of on our own. It's nice to talk to you. It's nice to talk to you today. You know
what
I mean?
Yeah.
Otherwise, I generally am, and I have to say, I enjoy it. I enjoy sort of being sealed off a little bit. I mean, it's kind of how I live anyway, but it's also, you know, because I'm not in the classroom, I'm not out in the cafes or whatever it is that I'm wandering around. I mean, I collect my stories when I'm wandering around. So this has definitely certainly made me feel alone in a good way, but also in a, you know, not so good way.
You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest. Yeah, I totally get that. And I have a bunch of kids, too, and I love them dearly. But, yeah, I hope school goes back into session, though I know it's not going to be a good idea, it seems, health-wise. But, man, they're, you know, I have seven altogether.
You have seven kids?
Yeah. You know,
wow.
It's a blended family.
Right.
Five or 12 and under. Two are in their 20s, so they're out doing their own thing.
Wow.
But, man, today they're all out doing their own thing. The little ones out playing, so it's quiet. But when they're all in the house, I don't have to explain it to you. You know.
Well, that sounds exciting, and also, you know, it sounds tiring. That's for sure.
I keep trying to quit drinking, but it's hard. You know. Oh boy. Anyway, what about the most recent published work, Maggie Brown and Others?
Yeah.
Give us a little insight on what you're trying to share through that work.
It's always hard for me to say. You know, it's got a lot of stories in it and built over many years. You know, built. I rewrite stories sometimes. I don't know, 10, 15, 20, sometimes 30. Oh, excuse me. 34, even 40 times, let's say. And so this book came about because I had I had these stories that were just ruminating for years. In some cases, even in one case, there's a story in the book called An Ineffectual Tribute to Len, which I started in 1999. I know because I remember the year and, you know, the time in my life that I was trying to write it. So it took 20 years, you know, to get that one. And so that's when I felt that actually when I finished that story and then when I finished the novella, which caps the book at the end, which also took many, many years, I felt, okay, you know, I mean, I feel like the time I put in the time, it was ready to go and I couldn't do anything more with those stories. That's when I thought it was time to put it out in the world. And I guess if I'd say what the book is about, which is always hard for the writer, you know what I mean? I don't know. You know, you guys tell me. But it's about memory and just, you know, most of my characters are characters who, for better or sometimes for worse, are, you know, pulled down and various ways by their past. And that influences the way they live currently. One thing I really make sure to do is have a real wide cross section of people, age, you know, where people are coming from in life, et cetera. And so, you know, so I've got stories set in the current times, stories set in the 60s, 70s, 80s, et cetera. So, but they're often most of the time they're dragged down by some things they can't forget.
When you say dragged down, what do you mean?
I shouldn't say dragged down. That sounds like a drag, doesn't it? They're battered. Is that any better? No. But I don't know about you, but I feel like when I am wandering around looking at people, which is how I find my stories, I always sort of wonder, you know, what it is that sort of, what is they're holding on to. And that's what I'm curious about. What people are holding on to.
What kind of keeps them from floating away or from disappearing?
Yeah. Or even, you know, yeah. I mean, that's a really good way to put it.
Yeah. Yeah. I reflect.
Or in fact, in some cases makes them float away or makes them float away metaphorically. Let's say, you know, makes me think of a Kafka story, The Bucket Rider, where he actually does float away. Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. I love Kafka. So these are all fictional characters, but they, right? Maybe based on some real people, but they seem pretty real to you based on the way you're referring to them.
Yeah, I mean, that's I think that comes from just the spending so much time with them that they, you know, that I think that's the, I think you put your finger on the real test of fiction. If they become real, I mean, they better be real to me. And I can only hope they're real to you. And if that's not the case, and I have to say in too much fiction that I read, I don't feel that way. But that's what I'm after. I want these people. I don't care about anything else, other than whether they are real to you.
Wonderfully put. Peter Orner on Troubadours and Rock on Tour. So we're just about done with our conversation. I'm wondering what's next. What are you doing with the rest of your summer? What are you doing in the fall? You guys know what you're doing up at the university yet? Maybe not. I'm not sure. So what's next?
What's next is the next hour. You know what I mean? I don't ever, I try not to plan too far ahead. You know what I mean? I'm in my office or my little studio every day trying to bang out some sentences. Mostly I'm reading though. And this time I'm just trying to figure out, like, you know, what's next for us all. You know what I mean? And I don't know. I feel we're in this weird holding pattern, don't you think?
Yes.
You know, it's almost like it almost feels presumptuous to be like, oh, well, I have this and this and this on my agenda. My agenda is pretty clear at the moment while I think about what's happening to us. I also have I'm jinxed by talking too much about stuff in progress because I feel like I can't talk about something that doesn't exist. But in this case, I feel like doubly so because of the situation we're in.
Yeah, it's making our weirdness even that we all have even weirder, I think.
Yeah. Isn't it? I mean, just, I don't know. I mean, again, it's not, yeah, it sounds weird to, it's hard to articulate, which I think is okay.
Well, it was a pleasure talking with you, sir.
Oh yeah. Likewise, Lawrence. Thank you very much. You made my lonely day.
Oh, cool. I'm honored. Peter Orner, look forward to more works, and I'm going to purchase right after we get off of this call, Maggie Brown and Others. I can't wait to read it.
I think today, I'm not sure if this is, sometime this week is the pub date of the paperback. So the paperback is now out. It's got a nice new cover on it. And so pick up a new paperback.
Excellent. We got the plug in. Beautiful.
Sweet. It's got a picture of a rat. It looks like summer. It looks like very summery. Even though I kind of write, you know, I don't write beach books. I have some stupid joke where I say, like, it's a beach book, you know, for people who go to the library in June. but they somehow, the little brown thought it was a beach read. So they put a raft on it, you know, with, like, legs dangling down, stuff like that.
I love it. I love it. Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lawrence. I appreciate it. And good luck with those kids and good luck with everything.
You too, sir. You too, Peter. Thank you.
See you, Lawrence. Bye-bye.
Bye.
today and tomorrow, and yesterday too. The flowers are dying like all things do. Follow me close, I'm going to Berlinale. I'll lose my mind if you don't come with me. I fuss with my hair and I fight blood feuds. I contain multitudes. Got a telltale heart like Mr. Poe. Got skeletons in the walls of people you know. I'll drink to the truth and the things we said. I'll drink to the man that shares your bed. I paint landscapes and I paint nudes. I contain multitudes. A red Cadillac and a black mustache. Rings on my fingers that sparkle and flash. Tell me what's next, what shall we do? Half my soul, baby, belongs to you. Oh, well, can I frolic with all the young dudes? I contain multitudes. I'm just like Anne Frank, like Indiana Jones, and them British bad boys, the Rolling Stones. I go right to the edge. I go right to the end. I go right where all things lost are made good again. I sing the songs of experience like William Blake. I've no apologies to make. Everything's flowing all at the same time. I live on a boulevard of crime. I drive fast cars and I eat fast foods. I contain multitudes. Pink pedal pushers, red blue jeans, all the pretty maids and all the old queens. All the old queens from all my past lives. I carry four pistols and two large knives. I'm a man of contradictions. I'm a man of many moods. I contain multitudes. You greedy old wolf, I'll show you my heart, but not all of it, all of the hateful parts. I'll sell you down the river, I put a price on your head. What more can I tell you? I sleep with life and death in the same bed. Get lost, madam, get up off my knee. Keep your mouth away from me. I'll keep the path open, the path in my mind. I see to it that there's no love left behind. I play Beethoven sonatas, Chopin's preludes. I contain multitudes.
Squirrel Tale. I have always distrusted squirrels. Walking in the park, with an eye out for chipmunks. Why don't I ever see chipmunks? I'll spy a squirrel, or two, or three, or more. There are so many squirrels in the world. And I think, what's to keep that squirrel from leaping up and plunging his sharp little teeth into my throat? There are, admittedly, few reports of squirrel attacks, and yet I'm wary, always looking over my shoulder as I stroll the park, like a mobster turned canary in the witness protection program, wondering when the whacking will come. Whence comes my aversion to squirrels? I was a big Bullwinkle fan growing up, and I held no animus toward Rocky, his plucky and loyal companion in pun-filled adventures. I always liked Rocky. I should have transferred my affection from animated squirrel sidekick to the flesh and fur animals scampering about the streets and yards and back alleys of my depressed former coal town. Perhaps it was coming across the tail of a squirrel in a junk drawer when I was an impressionable youth. There, amid bent Saints medals and broken penknives and cloudy magnifying glasses and tiny screws to who knows what, was the mummified tail of a squirrel. The discovery was repulsive and shocking, if not quite as revelatory as finding the bright yellow paperback of Portnoy's Complaint in my brother's dresser drawer. I was an inveterate drawer trawler. Why was the tail in the drawer? What happened to the squirrel who once gaily sported the tail? It's an unsolved minor mystery. I never asked my brothers about it, but I would occasionally open the drawer, gaze upon the dismembered tail with fascination and disgust, and quickly close it. Somewhere out there was a tailless squirrel, or more likely, the ghost of a tailless squirrel. And while it wasn't quite the curse of the monkey's paw, the vision of that appendage remained with me for decades. Would the squirrel's ancestors seek revenge upon the family who mutilated one of their own? My answer came many years later when I was the victim of a squirrel home invasion. I opened my door one day to the aftermath. Magazines and newspapers that I had planned eventually to recycle when they could no longer be ignored were scattered across the floor. The kitchen cabinet was open, and the plastic top of a half-eaten can of Blue Diamond Smokehouse almonds was torn apart. Almonds everywhere. The lid of a jar of peanut butter had deep scratches. The squirrel failed in his attempt to tear it off in a peanut butter-induced frenzy. Peanut butter, a pest control man later informed me, is squirrel crack. And I pictured a glassy-eyed addict slumped near an empty jar of Jif, his weeping girlfriend imploring him to get help. I surveyed the damage, hoping he wasn't hiding, waiting for the chance to spring out at me. I entered the bedroom, and there, on my desk, I saw a single almond. Now, I was picking up almonds for weeks afterwards, but I took this lone almond as a sign. An affront, really. It was a big F.U. from the squirrel. There he was, angry from his failure to open the peanut butter jar, his cheeks stuffed with my smokehouse almonds, making his way to my desk with an almond clutched in his tiny paw, a gleam in his black eyes. Here you go, loser. Thanks for the snacks. For days I would clap when I entered the apartment, to startle the creature in case he returned and was deep into a box of noodleroni. My landlord inspected the place, but couldn't determine how he got in. We could hear him scampering about somewhere in the roof above me, however, and he called a squirrel catcher. The professional put traps with peanut butter out, hoping to snare him and drop him off into the woods. Or so he said. Good luck finding fancy almonds in the forest, I thought with satisfaction. The friendly, non-exterminating exterminator caught the culprit, sealed up a hole in the roof, and told me to listen for the sounds of a trapped squirrel, perhaps a Confederate left behind. Time passed, and thankfully, no sounds. The squirrel must have worked alone. I didn't eat almonds for years.
Thank you. wish and hope and pray it might come true.
Isabella. Dog licks his chops as the little boy stops poking him in his eyes. I can barely remember my Siberian husky German shepherd, Isabella. Perhaps I was stoned and lost during that whole time. Perhaps I am still with this erudite Chihuahua Marquez at my feet.
Ain't got no home, ain't got no shoes, ain't got no money, ain't got no class, ain't got no skirts, ain't got no sweaters, ain't got no perfume, ain't got no love, ain't got no faith. I ain't got no culture, ain't got no mother, ain't got no father, ain't got no brother, ain't got no children, ain't got no aunts, ain't got no uncles, ain't got no love, ain't got no mind. I ain't got no country, ain't got no schooling, ain't got no friends, ain't got no nothing. Thank you.
And there you have it, episode 380 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. Writer Peter Orner, our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, and these musical artists, Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, Tre Los Chapas, Harry Nilsson, Bob Dylan, The Beach Boys, Nina Simone, and of course, Brentford Marsalis and Terrence Blanchard, too. And I'd like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and try to do our best with this time. Take care.